Welcome to this Innovation Forum podcast with me, Ian Welsh. I'm once again with Bastien Sachet, CEO of TFT, a regular guest on our podcasts. Welcome, Bastien.
Hello, Ian.
TFT have just published the latest in their palm oil paper series, Palm Oil Industry Transformation, which covers in some depth just that, the reasons behind the transforming palm oil industry. So, Bastien, just to set the scene a little, what do you think are the key steps in the chronology of the fairly amazing change we've seen in the palm oil industry since 2010?
Yes, I think just to say, we're hearing a lot of often bad news about palm oil, and you know, people from the outside might think that it's all disastrous and deforestation and problems. And I think in our paper, we wanted to show that in the last 7 years, really since 2010, we feel there's been an acceleration and an incredible transformation. I think the commitment that Nestlé made in 2010 to have their own sourcing policy, their responsible sourcing guideline, stipulating they didn't want deforestation and exploitation in their supply chain, was a history key step in the sense that the companies started to own their own policy instead of externalizing their principles and their values to certification schemes or roundtables. Before, it was easy to say, oh, this is the roundtable's fault if I'm not moving forward on my sustainability targets. From 2010 onwards, companies are taking responsibility. It's their policy applying on 100% of their supply.
So the companies are taking responsibility themselves now. So that's the difference.
Exactly. And what's been interesting since 2010 and that first Nestlé responsible sourcing guidelines is that the whole field of responsible sourcing has shifted. Of course, in palm, and then in soy and cocoa, etc. And you contemplate today, there are more than 360 companies worldwide who have such policy, which means this has triggered a wave of change. You ask me about the key steps. One key step is that Golden Agri, together with Greenpeace, TFT, worked on this HTS methodology, and we started innovating. This methodology is in constant evolution, of course, but that was another key step, because the Nestlé commitment triggered the need for innovation. It said, we don't know how to define deforestation, so how do we do it? And that's what got a very unusual collaboration to happen between Greenpeace, GAR. They had been fighting and they sat down together to innovate. And then from there, I think the next big step was 2013, the big commitment from Wilmar, which in a sense, you know, covered more or less 50% of the palm industry. And Wilmar making such a bold, ambitious commitment, led by their CEO, Mr. Kwok, was a historical signal to the whole industry, like, okay, this is where it's going. And then from there, you know, it gave confidence to brands, it gave confidence to other refiners and traders who embarked in the similar journey. So now, literally, almost 100% of the trading volume is the palm oil trade is covered by such commitments. Now, the challenge is on the growers and how these growers implement that and they find value in implementing it. Still a huge challenge. But in 7 years, what an immense amount of change when you compare to other commodities where people might have worked on sustainability for longer than that.
In your report, you pick out transparency as being a significant factor in all this progress. But what then have been the demonstrable benefits that you've seen for businesses around engaging with their suppliers and then sharing information with customers and NGOs? How did the journey, what did the journey look like?
I'd say one word, trust. We are in a society where trust is eroding a lot and opacity is acting against trust. And so it's more important for consumers to feel that their politician or their company or the brand they buy from is honest with them rather than believing in all the perfect advertising they might hear from them. They don't want promises, they want honesty. And I think the value of honesty as a trust builder is important. And how do you show you're honest? By being open, by being transparent. So I think this transparency is a trust builder. And through trust, you have value creation, you have innovation, you have a lot of things, a collaboration happening. So transparency fosters further collaboration. When you see what Wilmar is grappling with, suddenly on their dashboard, they had the courage to put all their suppliers on the dashboard. When you see that, you're like, right, it's quite a big task that they have to transform. So suddenly, for the brands, rather than firing rockets on their suppliers saying, you need to comply on this, you know, by tomorrow, by yesterday, they're like, okay, How have you been doing? How can we help you go further? And I think it completely changed the dynamics, because then suddenly the companies that's facing, like Wilmar facing all this transformation, they feel that their customers are starting to help. They get reward, they get support, and so they find value in doing that. So there is a whole dynamic that shifts with transparency.
So it has been really changing the way that so many companies deal with everyone else that they work with. Looking forward, you've outlined a vision for the future. Maybe we can look at some of the elements of that over the next few minutes. So firstly, you say that traceability is a means and not an end. So I'm wondering, in the context of halting deforestation, what do you mean by this exactly?
Traceability is a way to know and understand what you have to grapple with. You could say transparency, you could say traceability. It's a way to understand where the products come from. It's a way to build trust with your consumers, your clients, saying, I know where my supply is coming, which means you've started to address the problem, you've started to grapple with the issue. But showing high scores of traceability doesn't mean that the issues have been addressed. If you know you're sourcing from a company that is actively deforesting, for example, well, you know, great thing, but what are you doing about that? So as any indicators or metrics, you can very quickly get bogged down into this. And so traceability to me was great to identify the array of players and suppliers at the range of issues, etc. It was a good first step. And many people started to say, okay, next, you know, after traceability to mill, traceability to plantation. But if you have to trace to every single smallholders where the oil coming from, just to put a dot on the map, and then you can say, oh, I've got my KPI, we'll spend the next 10 years trying to find traceability to plantation. What instead I think we say is, once we have a good understanding of who to engage with in the supply chain in terms of suppliers, growers, let's talk to them and figure out how do we create value for all first and foremost. In that sense, traceability is not the goal. The goal is how do we create value together. Traceability will come as a, let's say, a byproduct, if you want, of that work.
Principle of creating value together is another of the things that you've picked out. I mean, you just say that there's a guiding principle of what's in it for me. And, you know, if growers see their peers being hammered by NGOs, for example, then I guess they're inevitably going to be reluctant to admit to any problem. So how can we get around this problem?
Yes, exactly. I think that today, the proposal that is made to growers anywhere in the world is, okay, if you can go below the radar, if you can be the one not picked by a Greenpeace or a RAND campaign, you're lucky. And you can carry on deforesting as much as you can, so, you know, because that's where the value is, expanding as much as possible. Because the whole responsible sourcing approach has been too focused on risk, too focused on identifying problems. So you got great satellite tools now saying, this is where the risk is, let's focus on the risky ones. What do we do with the guys who are doing okay? What do we do with the growers who have not been cutting down forests, who have been treating their workers correctly? They get no reward. They get ignored. They get no attention whatsoever. So, you know, what's the incentive? There's no virtuous circle to engage companies in a large number to say, I want to be like this. So what we're saying is, We need more mechanism that encourages those companies to be rewarded. And the good news is, we believe that in a supplier-buyer relationship, when a refinery or when a brand buys from a certain company, they have multiple tools to encourage, to create value for the guys who are more aligned with their quality policy, if you want. They can work on logistics, they can work on R&D, innovation, payment terms. It's not just premiums. There are many, many, many opportunities. But the buyer needs to know how is their supplier performing and be able to compare one another. And today, it's only a risk issue-based approach. There is no way to rank the supplier from very bad to very good, if you want. There is only the very bad signals that filter through.
Sure. And you highlight in your report as well that the use of technology and tools to help accelerate these sort of changes towards better relationships and better relationships for farmers and their people they're supplying to. So what sort of tools can work in this context then, and which ones don't?
If you compare the level of collaboration, supply chain collaboration that exists between a Unilever and a Walmart, they collaborate on everything. Delivery schedule, ERP, electronic invoicing, R&D, whatever you can imagine. The level of collaboration between a smallholder and a mill is close to none. So there must be value to be extracted and explored in improving the collaboration between a smallholder and a mill. Just by, for example, we work in our rurality project, we've identified that there is a mill with plenty of trucks, and they're like, oh, we don't know where the FFBs are. On the other side, the planters said, oh, the mill doesn't come and pick up the fruits on time. So what happens is the FFBs, the fruit bunches, they rot. And the free fatty acids, the FFA, which is an element of quality, they go up. So if you don't process the fruits very quickly within the 24 hours, the quality goes down. The smallholder doesn't get the premium for quality. The mill gets poor quality oil. Everyone's losing. If you improve the way the coordination between the pickup of the fruits and the processing is done by sharing more information between the farmers and the mills, like collection schedules, pickup, you know, logistical routes, simple stuff like that, you optimize the quality because the fruits are processed in time. Everyone's happy. Everyone gets a premium, both the mill and the smallholders. We're organizing that in different projects we work with, and we want to create models we can share with the industry that show how to do that better and at a bigger scale. So that's just one example, but there are many others.
So, I mean, smallholder farmers, we've talked about, I mean, they are at the heart of the transformation. That's one of your key findings. I mean, it's been very easy for smallholders to get left behind, perhaps because of the scale of engagement required. So beyond the example you just mentioned about with mill and farmers, what other approaches are you seeing developed that are transforming the relationships between big business and the smallholder farmers?
Well, the key for me is that if we go to the smallholders with a compliance approach, with a normative approach, with a bureaucratic approach, trying to impose certification on them, trying to manage their sustainability indicators, etc., there is no value for them in that. So it will fail, and it will cost a lot of money. So our approach is rather to say, we need to look at the farmer as a businessman. The mill or the dealer who buys the fruit from him is another businessman. These two businessmen need to do good business together. Let's explore any possible avenue. Because the relationship is quite similar across the industry, we don't need to go wide in trying to address everything at the same time, because again, this costs a lot of money, is not very innovative. Instead, we need to dive deep into those realities, and this is what we try to do with our projects, dive deep into the smallholder context, explore how value can be created between the mill and the smallholders. Not just focus on one actor in an isolated way. Let's focus on the whole supply chain, how to increase its resilience. And then, you know, if it creates value, it will spread by itself across the company, across the different mills of the company, across the industry. If some solutions are useful, they spread fast. Think about WhatsApp. Think about Airbnb. Think about Uber. It spreads by itself. You don't have to push for it. You don't have to market it. And our vision is that if we find what creates value for everyone at that level, it will replicate by itself. And that's what we're focusing our work on, rather than trying to do millions of assessments, millions of engagement, because it's too big. And by the time we'll have finished to engage everyone and put a dot on a map to say, oh, here is a smallholder, you know, then there'll be no forest left. There'll be lots of exploitation, lots of issues that we will have not taken the opportunity to solve.
This holistic approach you're talking about, I mean, it really does seem to be the way that the arguments and the debate is moving. I mean, everyone's now talking about the, you know, taking the landscape approach, bringing every element together, looking across value chains and across different everything that's going on in the landscape. So why do you think that this has become the way forward? Why has this caught the wave, do you think? And what are the barriers to this approach developing?
Because I think everyone's realizing two things. Is that a compliance-based approach where you run thousands of audits doesn't change anything. It makes people happy, it looks good on a sustainability report, but it doesn't drive change. What the world needs and what the industry needs is proper innovation. To do innovation, you need to focus your resources and your head onto a few things, and you need to collaborate. So the landscape approach is a way to focus the energies, the field engagement on certain territories that are important and that are useful to work on, and to have a platform to engage with the different stakeholders, because no one can solve it on its own. So the different companies of the same sector, linking with the pulp and paper, with the rubber, linking with the government, of course, who is the main stakeholder in the landscape level. And then there is a concerted approach of a certain territory. So because there is a need for innovation and collaboration. I always say the following. We are facing an epidemic of deforestation and exploitation around the world. No one's guilty for it. It's there. Okay. Now, how do we stop an epidemic? We can try to see every patient. If you think about the Black Death in the past, see every patient one by one. But it won't solve the epidemics. Maybe often the doctor gets exhausted. Or you can take the vaccination approach where you try to dive deep into understanding the mechanisms that are at play here and find ways to make changes, to create value, to find a solution that will spread by itself. And that's how the vaccinations work. You dive deep in a lab, you try to innovate, find how it works, find a solution, and then the vaccination spreads by itself. So I think the solutions we are trying to find, you know, when we dive deep into a smallholder project, we dive deep into a landscape, working with many skills, many partners, many industries, we're trying to co-design the vaccinations that will help us to slow deforestation and exploitation. And we hope that through this approach, we get a better chance to fight these bigger epidemics.
Sure. And I guess it's finding approaches that can scale, because getting things to scale is the number one issue, number one concern with all these problems. And, you know, everything on a small scale can work, but getting it to actually work across the landscape, that is the challenge.
Yes. Actually, what we feel is that many of the issues, they have similar patterns. They might not be the exact same, but they have similar patterns. So what I believe is that as long as we seek the value creation, scale will be there by itself. You get scale if you create value. You get Airbnb to spread because it creates value for everyone. And if it creates value, you know, naturally, it picks up. And yes, the countries are different, the laws are different, but Airbnb is everywhere. So why the solution that will be developed to fight deforestation, exploitation, can't be inspired from the pilots that are being rolled out at the moment? I think there is no major barrier to that. It's an attitude to approach the problems. And I'm very encouraged to see competitors sitting down at the same table to say, how can we do it right, you know? And I've got hope, actually, to see that kind of innovation happening at the moment.
Yeah. And I guess worker and labor issues are something that through the Pamble industry can learn a lot from other sectors. I mean, Wilmar and others have been in the spotlight recently regarding labor practices in their palm oil supply chains. And so, you know, do you get a sense that there's been a bit of catching up on palm oil social problems? Have we been looking at the environmental ones rather than the social, do you think?
Yes and no. In a way, I think the companies have decided to tackle this issue. They're doing it at the maximum of their capacity. I feel there's a goodwill, genuine intention to do well. But the spotlight is being put now by many organizations on that topic. So it will certainly accelerate and intensify the engagement there. Again, same process. There it will be a matter of innovation, about how do we adapt these big, great principles that are made in the policies into reality. And I think I was talking with a leading Indonesian company who was telling me, how do we do the HCS of social, you know? We have to innovate on those fields. And I agree with her. I think it's absolutely necessary to adapt and find practical ways to implement those human rights guidelines. I think everyone agrees on that. The companies first, that it needs to be addressed. The question is how. And our view is that let's dive deep into some situation in rural areas with the companies, co-design solutions, inspire ourselves from the work that has been done in other industries, and try to find solutions.
Looking to the future, you say in your conclusions in the report, let's not seek compliance, let's seek value. So is this really just the certification debate again? Or, I mean, what do you mean by this in practical terms beyond that?
Yeah, it's linked to that. Our goal, as often people think, we are trying to finger point the certification. For us, it's the philosophy of having a few people or organizations who are trying to herd everyone into a set of norms. We feel this is not the way to get scale, not the way to get innovation, not the way to convince people about why it's interesting to change. We don't believe into the model of giving premiums and getting consumers to pay for labels. We think it's failed. Recently, we saw Cadbury took off all their fair trade label from their packaging in the UK, I think. So it's all signals that this is not the model to fix and to solve the epidemics we are facing of trade labor, of deforestation, etc. Instead, I very strongly believe looking and inspiring ourselves from the Airbnb, the WhatsApp models, which have an incredible pickup in a connected world, that if the solutions we create are generating value for the users all across the supply chain, from smallholder to consumer, and there are solutions that can do that, then they will pick up and scale up very quickly. So then we have hope to solve the epidemic's slow deforestation in time. Now, in that sense, if we go to a mill or to a producer and we said, you should not do this, you should not do that, stop doing that, what's in it for him? Rather, if we go there with an attitude to seek value, we sit down with him and say, how do we make things better for you and for the world? Then it's a different proposal. Philosophically and practically, it opens the doors for innovation, it opens the brains, it builds trust, it allows vulnerability, while the approach on compliance, driven by compliance, is completely different. It's a blocker. So that's what we have in mind.
And do you think the industry is getting behind that shift, or is there still the compliance attitude?
I think we're still very much into compliance mode. There are lots of people benefiting from the compliance approach, from consultants, certification bodies. Everyone's very happy into this compliance road. But if you look, we are at the bottom of the Everest. The transformation is the Everest. And I don't see how we will interest millions of smallholders to change practices, not burn the forest, start hiring people legally, etc., if we don't change the mindset. And so for me, it's not like we have a choice. It's mandatory to adapt the approach. The industry, who is genuinely implementing for many, we know their policy, they're facing the same challenge. And they're like, well, we need to create value. Then it needs to be interesting for them, because we can't be pushing 800 mills and control them and police them. It's not our role. We want them to step up. And at the end of the day, just like they do for the quality of the oil, they can do the same process for the environmental and social quality and find it useful for them to do that.
Certainly, the compliance model hasn't really generated the scale that is required. Bastian, thanks to you. I can thoroughly recommend listeners the report, Palm Oil Industry Transformation. It's definitely worth a read. It's a great summary of what's happened so far and a clear route to the future for palm oil supply chains. But for now, Bastian, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Ian.